Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is Nina Miller. Miller is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, where she majored in creative writing. Most of her professional career was spent in human services. From 1973 to 1986, she was director of suicide prevention and crisis services. And from 1993 to 2007, she was executive director of Hospicare and Palliative Services, both of Tompkins County, New York. During a hiatus, she wrote short fiction and published many stories in literary journals and magazines. Now retired, Miller serves on the boards of Cinemopolis and on the development committee of Hospicare. She also still writes, and in 2015, she published a novel titled The Mother of Invention, published by Wasteland Press. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's fine to finally have you on. Now, I am curious about how someone who majored in creative writing ended up spending most of her career in human services. Tell us how that happened.
Well, we arrived in Ithaca in 1964. I had had a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship for graduate study, which was interrupted by the arrival of a baby a few years early.
Uh-huh.
We came here after my husband finished his doctorate, and he got a job at Cornell in the student health clinic. And I marched into the graduate school and said, well, here we are, and I'd like to finish my degree, only to be told that Cornell had no tuition benefits for faculty spouses.
Wow.
And that I would have to be a full-time graduate student. Well, we arrived with debts and two babies and no resources. So that was impossible. And I began to look for things to do. And I did all kinds of odd things. I corrected papers for somebody at Ithaca College. I taught students from, I think they were mostly from Africa. I helped them with their English at a Cornell course. And then I got friendly with some people who were interested in helping teenagers who got pregnant stay in school.
Yeah, that was your first job,
right? That was
right?
My first job. It was, you know, maybe 15 hours a week, but it was advocating with school districts, which at that time, we're just kicking kids out to keep kids in school and give them support. And that just opened all sorts of doors. I got involved in organizing the first Planned Parenthood. I was on the initial board. And all kinds of doors opened. It was so fortunate.
Well, so you know, you ended up in human services. Was this an interest of yours that you just clamped onto, or did you discover along the way that you were really good at this?
Well, I grew up in a very left-wing family that was deeply committed to making people's lives better. So I was, in a way, returning to a mission that my parents had exemplified for me. But I got hooked. I really got hooked.
Yeah.
The first real job was at suicide prevention.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
You were the director there for 13 years.
Yeah.
Tell us about that experience. Did you have to learn on the job about the whole issue and
sure
what the
did.
Public needed? And yeah.
I sure did. I knew very little when I started. The agency was relatively new. Mm-hmm. It was actually very new. So we were all learning together, but fortunately there were some wonderful role models out there. There was a terrific program in Buffalo, and we brought in the director and some of his staff to do some intensive training. And you know, I'm a fairly quick study, and because I write, I was able to use my writing in every job that I had. So I wrote the training manual and wrote the, you know, communications and so on. And I got to work with wonderful people. And we used a lot of professional mental health consultants, including my husband.
Yeah, your husband was a psychologist, right?
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Right.
Well, what did you learn in suicide prevention was one of the major things people who are trying to help people who are suicidal, what do they need first off to be able to do?
Listen. I really need to learn how to listen non-judgmentally. And I think SP does a terrific job in training people in good listening skills. People told me years later that they use those skills in every aspect of their lives. And actually, we were a trial ground for a lot of people who went on to become therapists. They learned a great deal working with people on the phones and decided that was where their professional lives were headed. So I think listening is the primary thing. Trying to withhold one's own need to jump in and give quick advice
yeah,
and quick judgment.
Yeah.
but to hear underneath what people are saying.
Yeah, that must be a hard skill. I don't think everybody could do that. I mean, even if you do, I know you have trainings, but still not every person is equipped to be able to listen.
We had a couple of lawyers who had difficulty with it.
Oh, gosh.
And a couple of scientists. There's a wonderful story, one I love to tell about a guy who was getting his PhD in one of the hard sciences, and he came and did the training, and we had an all-day session in listening skills. And at the end of that session, he was heading out to Chicago for a conference, and a friend picked him up, and he got into the friend's car, and the friend said, "Oh, God, I'm in such trouble. My marriage is falling apart. I don't know what I'm going to do." And this guy thought, well, I've spent the whole day learning these skills. I might as well try them. So from Ithaca to Chicago, he used reflective listening and open-ended questions. And at the end of the trip, his friend said to him, "Nobody's ever been as helpful to me as you have been." So he came back and he said to the group, "I'm sold."
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, that seems to be an old adage that we should have just in this culture, mm-hmm. because people just need somebody to listen to them. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming an art that's lost because, you know, 5-minute sound bites and quick conversations and texting. And it's people are losing the art of being able to communicate.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, after you worked for so many years in suicide prevention, you took a little bit of a hiatus and started mm-hmm. doing your creative writing. Tell us what that was like. Did you use some of your experience in human services as subject matter? How did you segue?
Not really. I had made a promise to myself that I was going, that writing felt like the unfinished business of my life. And I reached the age my mother was when she died. I was 46.
Wow.
And I suddenly realized that I had passed her by a few days. And I thought, I have to use time differently. This is a gift, this time. And what is left that I want to do? And writing was clearly the thing. So I rented a little one-room office downtown because I was used to working when you go to an office, and I thought I'll be better disciplined.
Ah.
And I was. I really treated it like a job. I went there 5 days a week and worked, you know, from 9 to 1 or 9 to 3. The kids were old enough so that was possible. And I wrote a lot. I published 20 of those stories, not in any memorable journals, mostly in small literary reviews, many of which are defunct.
But still, that's an accomplishment,
good.
Nina, really.
It felt good. And while I was doing it, I was still on a couple of boards. And I got called in the 7th year by Planned Parenthood. They'd had a crisis in their staffing. And they asked if I would serve as the interim director for 3 months. So I thought, well, sure, I can take 3 months out. Well, it turned into 7 enormously meaningful months. It was shortly after the clinic shooting.
Oh, yeah.
And my first job was to raise money to put Kevlar in the walls of the waiting room. It had enormous meaning to me to be there.
Yeah, and that sure was a volatile time. I mean, it continues to this day in many clinics in many cities. But God, you know, we never thought people would turn to violence for the sanctity of life philosophy, right?
I mean, yes.
So shocking.
A women's health clinic, yeah.
I know.
It was dreadful. Anyway, I realized when I was there how much I had missed the fray of human services.
And a camaraderie, probably.
Yeah, I was chairing the board of HospiCare at the time, and they had a staffing crisis and asked when I was finished at Planned Parenthood if I would serve as the interim director at HospiCare. So I stepped down from the board chair, and after 3 months, I said to them, "I'm not leaving.
Wow.
I love this job." And fortunately, they seemed to think that was a good idea, because it was an incredibly meaningful job to me.
Yeah, God, it's such an incredible service. You know, what is it about you that people come to you when there's crises in human services organizations, Nina? Did you ever think about that?
I don't know, but I think I've learned the secret of my success is always to follow a director who hasn't done well.
That way, and you can say that, right? I mean,
that way, if you say good morning to people, they say in a nice way, they say, oh, isn't she wonderful? No, I really believe that we have to value the people who are doing this work.
Oh, yeah. And it's such important work that you've gotten
involved in. Certainly not getting financially rewarded in this culture. But it is, the work they do is so vital. And I think a big piece of a director's job is to support them in that work.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about the history of hospice care there. You know, the first stages started in the 70s.
Right.
And then you got the Biggs Building.
It started actually, one of the great things about working at suicide prevention was that it was like having your finger on the pulse of the community. And we would get calls from people who were just at the end of their tether trying to care for a dying family member. And there were very few services available to them. And at the time, I was on the Comprehensive Health Planning Council. I think it was the Mental Health Subcommittee. And a few of us were looking at new directions. And we began to talk about the possibility of creating a hospice. So this was way back when, and it took a couple of years to put it together.
Was it a new idea then, or had it already started springing up?
It was relatively new. Yeah. The first one was in New Haven I think it was the mid-70s. It had begun in England with Dame Cicely Saunders, the focus, and that was mostly inpatient. And here we were looking at home care when we started. So we started in a volunteered room in the basement of, I think it was the Presbyterian Church, and hired a nurse who was the coordinator. And there were wonderful people involved in the training. Jack Lewis, you've probably heard about the legendary Jack Lewis.
I have.
He's been involved in every program I've cared about. He was one of the trainers. My husband was one. We had a number of people coming in to help people with their own feelings about death.
And you also had to deal with the family, too. I mean, that was a new initiative.
Yes.
To include everybody in all these.
Yes, the whole family is considered, you know, it's sort of the identified patient.
Yeah.
I don't even like that term, but provide care for all those who are involved. And sometimes that family is a very broad sense. It can be the close friends who are caring for somebody.
Yeah, and HospiceCare was one of the first organizations that would recognize that, you know? Remember when hospitals wouldn't let gay partners in, and, you know, those were the days.
Oh,
but HospiceCare never really started out that way, did they?
No.
Everybody was involved, and anybody could call, a friend could call to give a...
Yeah, I remember early on, when we were in the new building, one of our early patients was a young woman who was a lesbian and had this broad community of lesbian friends who'd been caring for her. And they'd done a spectacularly good job, but it became more than they could handle. So they brought her to the residence, but they were not going to just drop her and leave.
Yeah.
I would come in the morning and find them camped all over in sleeping bags. They wanted to be nearby. And that was fine. We accommodated people's needs.
It took a long time for people to learn to do that. I remember in the early days of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco, people would want to camp out in the hospital, friends, not husbands and wives. And people were learning to accommodate people to be able to understand that the family is an incredibly huge circle of human beings. Yeah. And so I'm very proud of HospiceCare for being on the, you know, on the cutting edge of that. It's such a great tribute. Yeah. Now, the first freestanding HospiceCare residence was started in around 1995.
It was the first in New York State.
It was the first in New York. I was going to say
that. It was quite a challenge.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
How did you fund this? What kind of connections did you have to make in order to have this happen?
Okay. Well, I was on the board at the time that we were raising money for the building. We did a lot of grant writing. We had wonderful help from our legislators. They actually had to pass a bill to create the entity of a hospice residence, because there had been no such thing.
Yeah.
So they did that, but they didn't bother at the same time to pass regulations on how you run it. So when I took over, the building was up and ready, but there were no regulations. So we kept pushing and pushing. And finally, we just opened. We took the risk. I had a wonderful, wonderful board of directors that was so committed to this idea of a home for people who had no place to go at the end of life or whose caregiver could no longer provide care, that we wrote our own regulations and opened. And now, of course, it's all, you know, everything is clearly stipulated. Yeah. But we were really pioneering
God,
this effort.
God, what a revolutionary idea that people shouldn't have to die in the hospital. It seems like mm-hmm. common sense
yeah.
to us now.
Yeah,
wow.
That you can die in a home-like setting. It's a beautiful setting. The gardens are extraordinarily wonderful. Yeah. I think the gardens are almost as important as the inside of the building for people. I watch families wandering through the garden or pushing a wheelchair through the garden and getting such comfort from the beauty of the place.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nina Miller. We're talking about her long career in human services. She worked for suicide prevention and was the executive director of hospice care here in Tompkins County. You know what I was going to ask you, too? Since it was a pioneering endeavor, did you have people say you guys are nuts? What do you mean you're going to not have somebody in a hospital who's dying?
We didn't have that argument. People thought we were nuts because we had stipulated that we would not turn anyone away because they couldn't pay. And that has remained a standard. So the people thought, well, you're crazy. How are you going to do that? And yeah. in fact, for a while, it looked like we were crazy when we first opened because people didn't know about the residence. It was not being very widely utilized. Mm-hmm. And without the census or the numbers of patients to fill the beds, we were really running a very expensive operation. So we actually shut it down for 7 months while I went about the community raising money so that we would have a fund to support those people who couldn't pay and to raise awareness of it. People would, at that time, there were very few meeting spaces in Tompkins County, and I would offer organizations the opportunity to meet at our building if they would allow me to lead them on a tour for 15 minutes.
Wow.
So we walked hundreds of people through the building. We had open houses. We did all kinds of things. We wrote articles to publicize it. And when we reopened 7 months later, we started filling, and it's been busy ever since.
Yeah, yeah. In those early days, what did you find that patients and their families needed the most? Was it, again, a listening or
what was it?
Comfort, obviously,
they need pain management.
Yeah,
before
pain management.
Anything else, they need to have their pain controlled. And hospice nurses and our medical directors are superb at pain management.
Yeah, that's what
I've
heard.
They will do whatever they can to make sure patients are comfortable. But it's a comprehensive approach. There is spiritual care. There is social work to provide psychological support. There is bereavement care for the families. And we have a wonderful bereavement coordinator. I keep saying we because my heart will always be connected to it. The agency has a superb new director, not so new director. He's been there for a while now, and he's done a great job.
Yeah.
And it just makes me enormously proud to see how that organization is blossoming.
Well, I can imagine that it got into your soul. I mean, honestly,
well,
what an incredible job the whole organization does. But to have been in the major, circle of that commitment and that incredible learning experience it must have been for everybody to figure out what people needed.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really extraordinary. And to see it grow, to take on palliative care, to get out in the community a lot more, to do community education, to have a music therapy program, which is a wonderful, innovative program.
Yeah. Did you have to be really assertive, too? I mean, it seems to me that there's so many restrictions, regulations, worry about controlled substances, that kind of thing. It seems like you guys had to be really, really assertive and revolutionary to be able to take care of people.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, there were some doctors who were a little uneasy about turning some of the decision-making over to our medical staff. And our doctors and nurses were very skilled at working with other professionals. So I trusted them to do what needed to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, 6 months after I retired, I became a user of the service.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that. 6 months after you retired, your husband, George, ended up... What was it, a heart attack?
Well, it was, we think it was ventricular fibrillation, AFib.
Wow.
He stopped breathing. We were in a car headed for New York. Fortunately, he wasn't driving. And while the EMTs came quickly, it took too long to get his heart going again. So he was in a coma for 3 weeks in a hospital in New Jersey.
Wow.
And at the point where it was clear that he was not going to recover, I asked to bring him back here, and we brought him back to hospice care. And so there I was at the other side of the door. And the care, I mean, George got the same wonderful physical care that every patient gets. I suspect we got more hugs than, but it was like bringing him home to family.
Yeah. What a shock, though. He was relatively young.
Well, he was 76.
That's
young. But he was a very young 76.
Well, 76 is young by today's standards.
And he had a full-time private practice, and he swam 4 days a week and was vital and very alive.
Yeah. So I bet your hospice comrades couldn't believe that you guys were coming through the
door. Yeah. And they were waiting for us when we got there, you know, with open arms. And, it really felt like coming home.
Yeah. God, you must have felt so lucky to have a connection with an organization that you knew was going to give you all good care.
Yeah, I really did. So it's really, you know, quadrupled my commitment.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, when I left my job, I thought, oh, good, I'll never have to raise money again. Very funny.
And you're on the development committee now.
Yeah, so now I'm on the development committee for hospice care and for Cinemopolis, which is, you know, one of the rich places in my life. I've always loved cinema.
Yeah.
And so I'm delighted. I called one day, and we had just been to the movies. My husband and I always went lots and lots to Fall Creek. And I said, you guys are fabulous. You do such a good job. If there's ever anything I can do to help, let me know. Well, that was a mistake. They did let me know.
They probably
called
you
immediately. But I loved working with that board.
Oh, yeah. I know, the creative arts. I mean, everything you've done is creative, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the human services stuff was a really creative organizations.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. You know what I want to talk to you about, too? Another thing that came from HospiCare is the women's swimming.
Yeah.
Tell us how that came about. It's such a great annual event.
I can take very little credit for that. Joan Brumberg was on our board of directors, and she was approaching her 60th birthday. She went to her doctor, Ann Costello, and Ann said, well, what would you like to do for your 60th birthday? And she said, I've always wanted to swim across the lake.
Ah.
And Ann said, great, I'll do it with you, Ann. A fine swimmer. And they began to strategize about how this could be used to make some money for HospiCare. They came and talked to me about it, and I thought, well, sure, maybe we'll make $5,000, but that's good money.
Yeah.
The first year we made $55,000.
I've heard that this was an immediate success.
And it just has grown, and it's an amazing event. It's really a community highlight.
Yeah. Did you ever do the swimming? Did you swim across the lake?
Not me. I am the world's worst swimmer.
Ah.
But I got wet. My job was to stand on the dock hugging swimmers as they came in, and I was as wet as they.
Yeah, what a great, that it's so exciting when I see it on Facebook, too.
Oh.
Women swimming is coming. We need you to donate to our swim across the lake.
They fill up the numbers of swimmers in hours. People just love the event.
Has it expanded out beyond our county and our community into other communities?
They have. I think it's Watertown that they are, I'm not quite sure where, they're doing a similar event. And there are a couple of other places that have consulted so that they can do their own.
Oh, I think that's such a great, you know, and it's such a spark of life to put into hospice care, which it should be.
Well, hospice, in a way, is really about life.
It is.
It's about living as fully as you can. And as freely as you can, free of tubes and
I know. Those hospital deaths
were
so devastating. That was our only choice way back when, as we all know.
Yeah, so. And we have a wonderful hospital. I'm in no way demeaning the hospital, but it is not a place one wants to die.
And I don't know anybody who would raise their hand and say, yes, I want to have my last day sitting in a hospital on tubes and a ventilator, you know.
Right, and yet so many people wind up with that experience.
Yeah, they do.
Because they can't confront the reality of what's happening.
Yeah.
And the irony is that hospice patients tend to live, in many cases, a few months longer than people who don't have that kind of care.
Yeah, I've heard that. Oh, it's an amazing service. So you totally retired a few years ago, and now you are writing, I would assume, mainly full-time, right?
Well, that's generous of you.
But you're also on boards, and you're still involved in the community, but you have more time, right?
I took a lot of time writing this novel because I wasn't working in a very concentrated way. I'm a lazy writer.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have to really push myself. I love rewriting, but it's that initial writing that's a struggle for me. Anyway, it was a commitment I'd made to myself. I said, you've got to get a novel done while you're still on this planet.
Uh-huh.
And so I finished it. And my son, who is a psychologist too, was very instrumental in the next decision. He said, well, Mom, now that you finished the novel, what are you going to do with it? And I said, well, I guess I'll start looking for an agent. And he said, ah, and how long do you think it'll take to find an agent? And I said, well, I understand that takes quite a while. It's hard. Maybe a year, more. He said, uh-huh. And then how long do you think it'll take the agent to place the book with the publisher? And I said, I suppose that could take another year or two. And he said, and how long do you think it'll take the publisher to really bring it out? And then he said, okay, Mom, to me, you'll always be young, but let's get real. And so I decided, he was absolutely right, I decided to self-publish. Uh-huh. And I have not regretted that. I'm not a marketer. The book has done wonderfully in Tompkins County, and there are some people outside of the community who've heard about it and have gotten it. But I've had such fun with it.
Yeah. Well, talk to us about the novel. It takes place. I liked it because it takes place in our world.
Oh, it does.
You can identify almost everything. Was the protagonist, Claire Goldstein, based a little bit on you and on people that you knew, or what?
Based on lots of people I knew. There's really one character who's based exclusively on somebody I knew well, and that's the older woman, Maud.
Oh, yeah.
Maud was based on a woman who had been very important in my life when we came to Ithaca, and I was unhappy. She had just been marvelous. But the others are really composites. A lot of the experiences are my experiences.
Yeah.
But I am not Claire.
But Claire's mother died young. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, you have a lot of the stuff that you've mentioned in your biography.
Yeah. Yes. And Marco is certainly not my husband.
He's
a total invention. I had played with names. I had an aunt whose last name was Capobianco.
And I know, and there's a Capobianco here in town who's an artist.
Right, I called her once to find out if there was any connection. So I just had a lot of fun doing it.
It sounds like it was a culmination of all, you know, the stuff you've been wanting to say in some ways.
Well, there's a hospice death in it.
Yeah.
And because it was, that death was based on the woman I had so loved. Every time I worked on that chapter, I sat and cried.
But it's a fascinating book. People, go out and get this book because you'll get into the mind of Nina Miller, and it's a great read, especially for those of us who live in this area.
Thank you.
And then they have copies at the library, too. I saw them.
Yes, they do.
And you can get them at the local bookstore. Now, we only have a couple minutes. I want to know if you're ever going to write about your experiences and what you learned in human services, because it seems like you have a wealth of wisdom from those jobs.
Well, that's kind of you. I don't know. I did a textbook years ago called Programs for People in Crisis. But, you know, I go to Z's writing circle,
Zahava's
writing circle, which is great fun. And I've been writing a lot there about a range of life experiences and, you know, periodically have ideas about pulling together some of those pieces. Some of them I think are very funny and some are immensely sad.
I think that would be very valuable for all of us to be able to read about some of your experiences.
Yeah, I feel very blessed to have had these experiences. I mean, only in Ithaca, I think. You know, I don't have the credentials to do any of the things I've done.
Those are the best people to hire. Hear me. Anyway, Nina Miller, we are almost out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a
great pleasure to finally talk to you.
It was great fun. Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.